Number seven, which is a briefing, shellfish enforcement from harvest grounds to the illicit marketplace. And this will be by Deputy Chief Mike Sensi. Some people are born to greatness, Mike, and others have it thrust upon them. So.
Thanks for trying to make sure I was lined out. Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, Director, Deputy Director, Director's not here. Afternoon, Mike Sensi, Deputy Chief Enforcement. So, there's many dimensions associated with shellfish enforcement, and I think you'll soon agree that the responsibility that we have as enforcers is fairly staggering, and I wanted to share what some of those responsibilities were. Some will probably be obvious to you, but maybe some others are not. By the way, this is my daughter, Echo Sophia. She was pretty excited when she harvested this sushi-grade gooey duck, and of course I tried to, you know, describe the natural history, and I was excited as well, and she said, Dad. I'm like, yes, honey. I don't care about that. How many can I have? And so I am better qualified to talk about harvest, and I leave the resource management aspect of this to someone more qualified than I, like Rich Childers. So bivalve shellfish is a really good example of where both aspects of our mission statement, the enforcement program's mission statement, are represented. The conservation piece is pretty familiar to folks, and that of course includes managing the state's naturally embedded shellfish stock sustainably in order to satisfy treaty rights, commercial fishing interests, as well as recreational opportunity, hopefully all at the same time. And what may surprise you, though, is our mandate to protect legal seafood industry and the consumer's health. And I'm not surprised that this isn't working because Murphy's Law. It's not working probably because the sound's down.
Got some help?
It's loading. Sure, the sound is up on the computer.
Is that sound up?
Is the sound on in the computer?
Ah.
We have to go, get out of there. And then...
Thank you, Madam Commissioner. That was exactly what the issue was. So as you can see, a very smooth transition here.
Perfect. A KCTS 9 digital studios. Clams, oysters, gooey duck. Northwest delicacies. But there's a dark side.
The clams are stolen.
Black market poachers stealing shellfish from polluted beaches.
It was just easy, fast, easy money.
But officers are on the case, chasing down poachers.
I need uniform.
Collecting the evidence.
This is making me ill.
And protecting both animals and people.
Police officers are the only thing standing between bad guys that poached bivalve shellfish and human health and safety.
They are the wildlife detectives.
Toxic shellfish. What's that got to do with us? Our agency is the primary enforcer of the Department of Health's sanitary shellfish laws, those criminal laws. And we've been the primary enforcer for decades, and in fact, we're specifically named in the Department of Health's revised code chapter. And our role in preventing unsanitary shellfish from entering the marketplace is not limited to harvest of natural stocks from public ground. It includes policing the private sector aquaculture as well. And a significant piece of what I see as a pretty massive responsibility is a U.S. FDA mandate to patrol growing areas with unsanitary conditions. If we fail to meet the established minimum patrol standard, our bivalve shellfish industry faces the threat of an embargo on exports. And you can see that it's a very valuable industry. $270 million a year is probably a conservative estimate. And even the jobs associated with that industry, the number you see here is probably lower than actual as well. But this industry is important to communities in a number of counties. You can see in this example that there are 11 defined patrol areas in Kitsap County, with six of them classified as high risk. The number of patrols that we're required to conduct every year is based on a risk formula, with a high risk classification requiring six site visits within 30 harvestable days. And when I look out across Puget Sound landscape and I think about our total obligation, I see as much as a 12,000 hour a year commitment for our staff. So from an FTE perspective, that'd be six officers fully committed to working sanitary shellfish exclusively. So we all saw what the effect of the West Coast shellfish ban imposed by China on our shellfish industry was like. There were concerns then over arsenic and PSP. And a failure on my end to meet the patrol obligation could result in history repeating itself. I got a call from Jennifer Kwan last night, who'd received information from Congressman Larson's office that we were potentially facing another ban. And just so rumors don't run rampant, what's actually occurring is that China is testing all high-value seafood to include bivalve shellfish like gooey duck, and that testing period could take between 48 hours and 72 hours over concern over organic arsenic. And so is that a real issue? Is there a political issue there? I don't know what we're doing in the South China Sea these days, but there are a lot of probably things wrapped up in those sorts of decisions by other governments to accept our seafood. But we have a responsibility to make sure that that the integrity of our industry is intact, that it's protected.
Yes.
Could you explain how you define high risk? How you assign that category?
So we don't assign it. The Department of Health assigns that. It's based on a number of factors, and when I'm done here, I'll get into a little more detail there. So just I guess to summarize, you can see that in Kitsap County alone, we have 11 patrol areas and six are designated as high risk. And when the formula is applied, that's 16 site visits within 30 harvestable days. That's a lot of commitment. That's a lot of commitment. Large tracts of Puget Sound do remain unclassified for commercial harvest, and until they are classified, these tracts are not part of any U.S. FDA patrol mandate, but clams are still poached regardless of classification. and some are toxic regardless of classification. And commercialization definitely occurs without certification. So as we clean up the Puget Sound, as we open more beaches for legal commercial harvest, that's going to result in a mandate to patrol more beaches. And as an agency, we haven't really been involved in ensuring that we have the resources to ensure that initiatives result in orderly outcomes. Ironically, success with some of these initiatives are going to result on result in impacts to my staffing levels. It's going to have an impact on our workload. There's a very vibrant commercial market hungry for good deals on seafood, and feeding that market is often a desperate person who found a pretty quick source of cash. An all-too-common thread among shellfish poachers is a drug habit, and a drug user slash poacher is really not likely to be concerned over things like the threat to public health, the threat to conservation, the threat to orderly fisheries, and certainly they're not all that concerned about a threat to legitimate industry.
Every time we'd sell, like, to the main person we sold to, it was, you know, we'd make like $300 or $400, and it wouldn't only take a tide to dig it, you know. So it was pretty good money. Well, when we were down there digging some clams and selling them to the Asians, and got caught digging them, and found out that we were going to lose the driver's license for 3 tickets.
I mean, they were saying jail time, not just a little, not just a few days of jail. You know, some time. And I don't. Well, I've already been done that, and I don't want to go back there.
Yeah, that did not. I mean, we had no clue. We were selling it to the restaurant. They were selling it to the people. We knew it. And I never thought nothing about it. It seemed so minor. The crime, you know, seemed like you weren't really doing anything wrong. You're just down here digging some clams, you know. We go sell them over here, but you know, really, you know, when you get looking at the big picture, it's pretty serious.
So all bivalve shellfish that's taken in commercial quantities for sale has to be certified by the Department of Health as safe for human consumption. And the product is tracked with a certification tag from harvest grounds all the way to through the marketplace and until it reaches the end consumer. But a lot of shellfish is stolen, and because it's stolen, the certifications either don't exist or they were falsified in order to hide origin. And either way, our ability to trace it backwards, should there be a health outbreak, is defeated. And biotoxins from contaminated beaches, we all know they can be lethal, and they're not destroyed by cooking, by freezing. There's no antidotes to biotoxins. Now, this past year, we had beaches closed to because of the threat of or the presence of domoic acid, diuretic acid, paralytic shellfish poisoning. And I can tell you with confidence that we had plenty of folks harvesting in those areas. And unfortunately, some of that product was making it to a very willing marketplace that wasn't concerned about the risk. The Department of Health reported that there were 109 cases of illnesses caused just by consuming shellfish with Vibrio bacteria in 2013. The Center for Disease Control Prevention estimates that for every single reported seafood sickness, 156 go unreported. When you think about it, you have a bunch of burly guys watching the Super Bowl, drinking a cold one, eating some oysters, and somebody gets sick. Are they going to call the Department of Health? Probably not.
Despite the blocked view, the sale takes place. Officers arrive to make arrests.
All right, we're recording. Do you have any Department of Health licenses that would enable you to sell shellfish or buy shellfish? Okay. Why don't you tell me about these?
Her name is Brandy. Yeah.
She sells clams?
Yeah.
Okay. Why do you have her phone number here?
Because she write out for her name number.
Why?
Yeah. Because she said, if somebody they want a clam, call her.
Okay. If somebody wants a clam, call her.
Yeah.
Through Facebook, I was able to locate at least her first and last name. She's a 38-year-old woman. She's Caucasian. She is a methamphetamine user. She is not employed in any legitimate industry. She's got a pretty harried past. Burglary, trafficking, and stolen property. I would say that she pretty well mirrors the profile of the illegal harvesters and suppliers that we've encountered so far in this operation.
The next day, the suspect calls the video store. She has clams to sell.
She's here.
So our detectives watched her go in. When she came back out and started to leave, our uniformed officers were called in, then they stopped her in the parking lot.
Both were in custody.
Once arrested, she cooperates with the investigation.
She gave us the whole start to finish ins and outs of her operation. We have to find a way to break through that barrier and explain that this could be lethal.
So the Puget Sound covers 1.6 million acres, has 2,500 miles of shoreline, and our marine and terrestrial officers have a lot of geography to patrol to address illegal harvest. And that's in addition to thousands of traditional businesses that have to be inspected to ensure that safe shellfish reaches the consumer. And then you have this illicit marketplace. Non-typical establishments like video stores, nail salons, teriyaki joints, storefronts where, the public is attracted may not necessarily be associated with the seafood trade from the outside, but it's happening in the alley behind it. I mean, I know our statewide investigative unit does not drive by a nail salon these days without wonder how many shellfish got traded there. Our female detectives also have had their nails done courtesy of the state of Washington while they occupied their undercover capacity over the last 2 years. There's also different scales of abuse, like the example here. This required a massive investigative investment. And depending on how you crunch the numbers, and how far back you go, it involved about $2 million in stolen oysters and clams. Much of it was illegally cloaked as safe private sector aquaculture with false health certifications, which, of course, defeated traceability. And our detectives combined a little Sherlock Holmes with good old-fashioned game warden tactics, but nothing about this case was rudimentary. There were a lot of surveillance nights. That's the good old game warden tactic piece, tailing the bad guys and the crew, sometimes in extreme weather. But more months were spent executing search warrants on bank records, conducting some forensic accounting, connecting the records with markets that were receiving the stolen goods. And that was very tedious and time-consuming work. This case really does demonstrate the interplay between public safety, public opportunity, and natural bed sustainability. This particular operation could have upset the balance for tribal and non-tribal resource sharing obligations and jeopardized opportunities for the public, because you all know we have a legal obligation to provide shellfish harvest opportunities to the treaty tribes on public tide lands. And under our current management objectives, there's no open non-Indian commercial seasons for oysters on public tide lands. Instead, we manage those critters exclusively for recreational and tribal interests through an agreement. And so areas that are remote to public access are set aside for tribal harvest. Those areas that the public can access and readily access are set aside to meet recreational needs. This guy was stealing from those remote areas. So you're impacting the treaty right, which then could change the balance of the rest of the available harvest grounds for the public harvest. So it was an intensive investigation, and this particular fellow went on the lam for a while. He was extradited from Hawaii. We actually received our first governor's fish and wildlife warrant, warrant for a fish and wildlife offense. Usually it's done at the local level, but it was an extraditional warrant, and King County, where this guy was ultimately prosecuted, went there and brought him back. They were kind of messing around with bringing this guy back to justice. Our detectives were concerned that he'd get tipped off and go on the lam again, when they were anxious to bring him back before he went underground. And they were pushing King County to go ahead and execute this. And they do it for free. It's part of their job. Lieutenant Golden, who's seated behind me and who leads SI, our statewide investigative unit, reminded King County that we have the authority to go get them ourselves if we need to, which surprised them. They realized that a trip to Hawaii was quickly slipping, and so they got right on it. And they grabbed him, they brought him back, and he's now doing 66 months in prison for stealing shellfish from both public and private lands. So to be fair, not all markets know they're getting illegal product. The bottom line is that the primary tracking system that we rely on to trace shellfish from market back to origin, should there be an outbreak, it's very porous. We're working on changing that, but the profile of the problem hasn't been that high, although I think we're increasing it. This is the Department of Health system. They are very solid partners with us. We do a lot together. But the bottom line is it's a very cost-effective system, and if you're going to improve it, money's got to come from somewhere to do just that.
On oysters or clams in the last few years, you might have eaten stolen shellfish.
Investigators say an undercover sting netted a harvester who sold stolen oysters and clams to some of Seattle's top seafood restaurants and wholesalers. Come of course, Lisa Jaffe joins us live now from the King County Courthouse. So Lisa?
And Molly, the upcoming trial here revolves around illegally harvested oysters and clams, and the prosecutor claims greed put the public health at risk.
Oysters are good as gold in Elliott's Oyster House. They sell millions a year. But a sting operation revealed something fishy about one of Chef Robert Spalding's former shellfish suppliers.
There's dishonesty in all businesses, and unfortunately,
It got him in the shellfish industry.
The Seattle restaurant is among 36 businesses, including the Brooklyn, the Earth Farm, and Barclay Seafood, that investigators say unknowingly received stolen or uncertified shellfish from GNR Seafood out of Quilsey. Prosecutors claim the owner of GNR Quality Seafood got his employees to go out at night and secretly harvest shellfish from state and privately owned beaches, and then go out and sell those oysters and clams to restaurants, seafood markets, and wholesalers all around Seattle.
Washington State has one of, if not the safest, oyster harvesting industry in the world that I'm aware of. And when people don't follow those rules, it puts people at risk.
Spalding says his team follows stringent standards, even testing their oysters independently for contaminants, and that GNR didn't raise any red flags.
I ate quite a few of them myself.
GNR's owner, Rodney Clark, is accused of stealing and trafficking more than $700,000 worth of clams and oysters from beaches in Kitsap and Jefferson counties between 2009 and 2010.
We are all affected by one bad oyster farmer.
Kevin Riley is an oyster farmer who delivers to some of the same restaurants. And he says when one person poaches, it can sicken customers and taint harvesters.
It just makes it look like we're all doing it wrong. When we're all doing it right and one guy is doing it wrong for profit.
11.
So our shellfish managers have been, so moving on to another aspect of shellfish enforcement, our shellfish managers have been worried about goey duck track recovery for some time as they see populations slipping in areas where there should be growth. And we work very closely with our harvest managers to focus our efforts. And we make some cases, but it's really tough going. When you have a high-value resource that's harvested out of sight underwater, it's flown out of state the same day that it's harvested, and then many of the participants are out of reach in a foreign country, our ability to detect poaching and abuses is very challenging, to say the least. When you add in that these are slow-growing, long-lived critters, and you know, we have our limitations on staffing, there's some very real vulnerabilities to over-exploitation. It goes beyond, goey duck enforcement work goes beyond catching a bad guy that may retrofit a boat like you see up here in the upper right-hand corner, and then fishing under the guise of some or poaching under the guise of a legitimate fishery. There's where there's a lot of money involved, you have organized and complicated approaches to cheating. And the folks that I rely on most to unravel the complexity are the men and women that make up our statewide investigative unit led by Lieutenant Paul Golden, who's behind me. And those cases often spill over into fraud. They spill over into financial crimes, money laundering, even extortion in some cases, and other criminal conduct that requires dedicated subject matter expertise if you're going to unravel the complexity in order to address it. And we barely have the capacity to dig very deep.
Of all the shellfish that sell on the black market, one clam is above the rest.
The goey duck. Most Americans have never heard of, much less eaten, a goey duck. So why is there such a thriving black market for their meat?
Before we answer that, let's get a couple of things out of the way. It may be spelled geoduck, but it's pronounced goey duck. And yes, it does look a bit like a giraffe. Goey ducks are the largest burrowing clam in the world. Predominantly found in Puget Sound, they can live up to 160 years. That's one of the longest lifespans in the entire animal kingdom. An adult goey duck weighs around 1 to 3 pounds. And in Asia, their meat is a prized delicacy. About 90% of the goey ducks harvested in the U.S. are sent across the Pacific. That's about $70 million worth a year. In China, goey duck was once reserved for elite banquets. But China's growing middle class has developed a taste for the delicacy.
and the disposable income to afford it. This rising demand has sent Gooey Duck retail prices to as high as $150 per pound, and soaring prices create a big incentive for poachers. Here's how it works. Harvesting wild Gooey Duck is only allowed in certain areas of Puget Sound. The state auctions off each area, but there's still a limit on how much can be dug up within each area. When divers reach the quota, they're supposed to stop. But fish and wildlife managers have found that sometimes they don't. That's when the poaching takes place. The most common trick used by Gooey Duck poachers is to dive when nobody's watching, sometimes in the middle of the night. Divers are known to leave bags of Gooey Duck on the seafloor to retrieve later. Or they hide the clams in the hulls of their boats. The more that don't get counted, the more they can harvest. Or they keep only the top quality Gooey Ducks and pitch the others overboard. Sometimes, poachers will even go to polluted areas where harvesting isn't allowed. A good diver can harvest thousands of dollars worth of Gooey Duck in just a few hours. Then, all they need is a buyer and a fake certification tag. In a matter of hours, boxes of Gooey Duck are headed to Asia, where diners shell out big bucks for them.
So going beyond bivalves, very quickly touch on some of the other resources, shellfish resources we police. The value of crab continues to rise, and so does the poaching. Our officers have uncovered a lot of illegal operations in markets. Last year, I think we shared with you an operation known as Argent Sale, and it involved about 70,000 pounds of undocumented crab, as well as undersized and close-season crab, that went to a single dealer by multiple suspects. And there were about a dozen businesses that were implicated in that case as well, in addition to this primary business that accepted the large quantity I mentioned. This year was no different in that we invested a lot of time and effort on some high-profile suspects that were causing a lot of damage. A lot of crab poaching occurs at night, but also around the periphery of regulated fisheries where the poacher uses that open season as cover, and then they commingle that illegal catch with legal catch. And it's a real challenge trying to unravel those kinds of strategies. But we do unravel them, and we do make cases. Puget Sound prawns are also a very popular target for poachers, and there was one significant case this year that involved quantities that alarmed our managers. They felt that the amount of poaching that was occurring by this person was coming close to causing a real conservation concern. So shown in the photo on the left is that particular poacher's truck, and the car that you see on the flatbed truck belongs to his illegal market, who also happened to be his drug dealer. So I'm never using this slide again because not a single person laughed. I mean, I barely saw a smile crack. What I'm trying to illustrate here is that our brand of law enforcement will always come with some creative tactic to cheat conservation laws. Without too much effort, I'm pretty confident that we'll be able to find a creative way to pinch old Frosty and his friend here before Christmas. But with shellfish enforcement, it's not the enforcement landscape is not that straightforward. It is very complicated. It takes a lot of effort to unravel the complexity and police it and maintain order. Our staff is tasked with many competing priorities, and I worry about being able to sustain doing a decent job. I'm about to wrap up, but before I do, I wanted to point out two people who consistently occupy leadership roles in solving shellfish-related management and enforcement-related problems. You must know that Rich Childers is one of your most committed employees, and he and his staff are such a pleasure to work with. And they're always trying to complement our efforts with sound management decisions, sound policy decisions, and that doesn't happen by magic. It really happens because they make huge investments in strategizing with us, coordinating with our stakeholders, and putting it all together in a meaningful way. And then someone that you probably don't know is Lieutenant Paul Golden. He's in plain clothes behind us, trying to look incognito. He supervises our statewide investigative unit, and his office is upstairs in the agency building here. He tries to find ways to solve problems so he doesn't have to constantly revisit them. And under his leadership, his team of detectives have been responsible for daylighting some pretty significant resource ripoffs that, frankly, your average bear might not have uncovered. And he's also always thinking about how we direct our field patrol force. So as they gain intelligence on poaching, he's directing our field force so that we can try to get ahead of it. Because the uniformed folks can't do it all alone, and he can't do it all alone, but they have distinctly different roles. He has the ability to go deep, and we need that tool in our program. It's very valuable. So he's my Mission Impossible guy with an inherent understanding of needing to do what matters and not what simply entertains us. And this job can be pretty entertaining. And he knows that if we ignore this aspect of work, we potentially put a $270 million industry in jeopardy, along with public opportunity and the public's health. So happy to answer any questions. Oh, I just also, just one more shout out. You know, I used a lot of KCTS clips here. I just wanted to acknowledge that Katie Campbell, who works for EarthFix, she was embedded with us for about a year, and she helped us tell a very important story. Some of those clips from her presentation were used in this presentation. And if you want to look at the full piece, you can go to their online programming and find it if you were to use their search function and type in Poaching the Puget Sound. That's all I have.
Thank you, Deputy Chief. Questions?
Go ahead. I guess just a point of clarification, Mike. The health department monitors these areas that raise clams, and then they tell, or oysters, and then they tell you, is that, because you kept talking about monitoring these, and they tell you that they're unhealthy, so you just monitor them so that there's no harvest going on?
That's basically it, sir. So the growing areas, those that are classified, are divided in terms of, you know, a risk of poaching, and that risk formula has a number of elements in it to include, you know, remoteness from communities and prying eyes. And so they designate these patrol areas, and the sites that require patrolling are identified, and then you know, there's a formula that's used that tells us how many times we have to visit that particular site. But it's not a DOH or Department of Health mandate. The International Shellfish Interstate Shellfish Sanitation Program has a uniform policy with respect to states patrolling their harvest grounds adequately in order to export their product. and the U.S. FDA enforces that that policy. And so we don't have a choice. We have to do this. We have to do this work if our industry is going to continue to be able to export product.
Really nice introduction to the topic. You made the point that sometimes these enforcement, these violations, enforcement challenges involve, get to the level of conservation concern. So how is that evaluated? And does that lead you to, I think I got the sense that it leads you to prioritize those things that lead to conservation concerns that are at the scale of creating a conservation concern. But do you go across the spectrum of shellfish harvest and look for those areas? Or how do you determine a conservation concern is involved?
Well, we're not necessarily doing it ahead of time. I think that statement was, you might have been reading too much in the statement I made, giving us too much credit. So with respect to the prawn poaching, we know that that particular resource can't sustain a lot of harvest in general, let alone illegal harvest. And so when we began to watch a particular bad guy's activities and estimate the number of poundage this person was taking out of the environment, the poundage was significant enough to sound the alarm bells with our resource managers. You know, they start to see that this person was responsible for a significant percentage of what would have been allowed in terms of overall harvest. So that's what I meant about, you know, some of these activities are so egregious. The amounts of product that's stolen so large that our biologists knew that if that was extrapolated out, the resource could never sustain that kind of pressure. Did I make sense? I hope I did.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Carpenter.
Chair. Mike, this my question may not be something we want to go into today. It might be kind of lengthy, but since when I first got on the commission, I remember a situation where there's two things I want to raise. The first one was, I remember the department ran the gauntlet up the Columbia River and had a fairly significant enforcement scenario there. I think that's 3.5-4 years ago. That's the first one. Haven't heard a word about since. The other one was the nail salon piece that you raised, which is now probably, 2 years old? I haven't heard anything on that. So maybe the Fish Committee, we can meet with you at the next go-round and get briefed on this, because I kind of wonder what happens to these.
And we'd be happy to discuss outcomes. And I thought of something else that I'd like to share with Commissioner Wecker relative to your question. So with respect to gooey duck, you know, we do have some upfront information from our resource managers that there are activities that where we don't have a suspect that are impacting that resource. So as they do these post-harvest surveys on tracks that should have recovered 30 years after the initial harvest and the gooey duck clams aren't recovered, you know, the alarm bells are going off. And when they see signs of fresh harvest, when they do those surveys, the alarm bells are going off. When one population in the same basin is recovering, but another population isn't, and there's some other signs, you know, indicators are that poaching's having an impact. And when Bob Sizemore and Rich Childers smoosh it all together, they see a trend that poaching is a significant factor, and if it continues, then there's a conservation issue somewhere down the line.
Thank you. Yes. Commissioner Grable.
Officer Cenci, you've made several very detailed and impressive presentations to the commission, and I commend you on how well organized, and they make a terrific point. And they always point to the economic value of these resources as well as the public health issues. Have you had the opportunity to do these presentations, say, to the Natural Resource Committee? I know that we're always in need for additional officers in the field, and if there's these are very dynamic in terms of presenting the good work that you do, the value of the work you do, and there's a need for additional enforcement officers, and this would help substantiate that.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know that members of the commission have met with some key legislators and suggested that, you know, we elevate some of these issues, and so I anticipate that there'll be some movement on that front, and I think that's valuable. I mean, our legislature should understand that there are certain things this department is responsible for that if we don't do the work, affects all citizens of the state of Washington and not just, you know, our traditional user groups. For instance, anybody that enjoys eating safe shellfish in this state should appreciate the service this agency provides with respect to a lot of the work that you saw here today. And hunters and fishers shouldn't pay for our services. Those services shouldn't come out of the wildlife fund. They should come out of the general fund, which, as you know, has been a declining balance for the agency and for the enforcement program. General fund represents only about 31 to 35% of the chief's budget. And so, there's supposed to be a lot of coverage there: boating safety, public safety, commercial fisheries, ESA listed critters, this kind of work. Well, at some point, the balance doesn't match up with the amount of activity that we have to police, and I think we need to have that discussion with the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have one more question.
I hope I didn't just get myself in trouble, but
you didn't go into the cooperation with the tribal enforcement, but I am kind of curious, given that this arena that you're talking about, assuring shellfish public health through shellfish sanitation, what role does the tribal enforcement play, since we're kind of the named agent?
That's a great question. So the ISSC, the Interstate Sanitary Shellfish Committee, actually defines what a law enforcement officer is as it relates to conducting these frequency patrols, and that would exclude, unfortunately, a tribal officer. So we cannot use a tribal officer's time and site visit work in order to help offset the impact to our staff. And it makes no sense. The tribes have qualified law enforcement officers that actually collaborate with us directly in making sanitary shellfish cases. The Suquamish tribe is a really good example of where their officers are very vested in, stopping a harvest of polluted shellfish. And yet we get no credit for that effort. If the mandate is that I conduct 16 patrols, here's the other kind of flaw in the formula, if you will. If I'm mandated to conduct 16 patrols and my staff goes out there and on patrol number two catches two bad guys like you saw in the video clip, and they don't want to be in trouble with the law again, they might be going back to jail, so they roll over on all their illegal markets. And now our statewide investigative unit gets involved, and they take down a dozen illegal markets. So these poachers and those markets were responsible for the movement of, let's just say, 50% or better of the shellfish that were illegally removed from those beaches. None of that work counts. None of that work matters If I miss the rest of my patrols in that tide cycle, that 30-day window, too bad. Technically, I failed. That makes no sense. So I think that the states that have shellfish resources in them and this responsibility should be given more credit for a comprehensive effort to stop the movement of toxic shellfish or unsanitary shellfish through the marketplace. And it shouldn't just be focused on, you know, monitoring the harvest sites. It should be the whole enchilada.
So you have no other comments? Thank you, Deputy Chief.
Thank you.
Very critical work and great presentation.